Join us today. Welcome to the show. This is the end of the second full week of our broadcast here in Greenville, South Carolina. And as I said, we're just very happy and glad that you've joined us this morning. We hope that the insights you learn from this show and the interaction that you have with God's Word and your own thought process about liberty, as well as public policy, will be of great benefit to you. Your questions and comments are as always welcome on the show. You can call us. All right, call the show at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. You can also email us your questions and comments to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Remember, if you're listening to this show at any time besides 7:30 to 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern Time, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we're glad that you are. If you're listening to the recorded broadcast, we do receive emails at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the next available show, and the next one will be Monday, we'll be happy to read those emails and on the air and then comment accordingly. We thank you for your great support. We're also soliciting information and donations and other things from people who are willing to help us extend our broadcast to other places further than the 10-mile radius we currently have around Greenville. We're hoping to start up an internet broadcast. If you're willing to help in any way, the Tyranny Response Network, as you notice, we are listener-supported. We have very few of any kind of commercial advertisements whatsoever, and we don't have any advertising income, so to speak, at this point. We'd be more than happy to talk with you, even if you can make a small contribution, or if you're willing to help us technically or in any other way. Just send me an email to questions@policyofliberty.net, and I'll make sure I pass it along to the Tyranny Response Network staff, the board, and so forth, and they can get in touch with you about how you might participate in this important and great project. Well, yesterday in the news, we had the President of the United States sworn in. CBS News reports that the second term begins with a prayer. President Bush, head bowed in prayer, on Friday opens an ambitious second term in which he boldly promises to reshape Social Security and spark democracy in the Middle East. His Republican allies say they're eager to begin, while Democrats vow to resume their fight against extreme GOP policies. 4 days of celebrations surrounding the Bush inauguration and end Friday with a national prayer service, a tradition that dates back to the inauguration of George Washington. The service, Mr. Bush's second visit to the church in 2 days, is to bring together 3,200 invited family, dignitaries, administration officials, and other guests of the majestic Gothic-style sanctuary of the Washington National Cathedral. And it goes on and on, talks about his agenda. Well, the problem with this is Mr. George Bush is doing it again, especially to the gullible people on the Christian right who voted for him. He is out there going to a prayer service, acting like a Christian, when in fact we know full well from his actions, whether they be in the Middle East, towards abortion, towards public schooling or government schooling, Department of Education, and many other things in his administration, not to mention the Patriot Act. And the loss of rights we have through increases in government size, we find that George Bush has been a sellout, and he's certainly not been acting like a Christian. He has certainly not been the supporter of Christian values that many apparently hoped he would be. Now, in all fairness, they did not think he was as good, many Christians, as somebody like Alan Keyes would be, or perhaps others. But nevertheless, they thought he was far and away better than John Kerry. I submit to you this morning that I don't see that much difference between George Bush and John Kerry. Certainly in their personal philosophical beliefs, there might be some difference, maybe. At least that's what comes through on the lips of George Bush, that there is a major difference between he and John Kerry. But that remains to be seen. And so far from his first term and the part of his second term that, or you know, since the election, we have not seen any indication of any change in his plans. So George Bush, the sellout, inaugurated yesterday. Mr. Baldwin, who was one of my favorite writers, Chuck Baldwin, former vice presidential candidate for the Constitution Party, issued the following statement. I'm going to go ahead and read, I think, this in its entirety. Chuck Baldwin is just so excellent in many things that he writes, and from time to time when I receive his comments, I think they're very apropos to read on the air, especially because they do lend itself a little bit toward the Christian worldview. Now, when I say that, I think that before I read this, let me interject this thought. Christians need to be thinkers, and right now they're not. Christians in general are gullible people, and perhaps that is the case throughout history at all times. Christ calls his people sheep, and Paul tells us there are a few who are wise and noble among their ranks. That's in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. These election cycles and the response to public policy that we see in the United States is indicative of the gullible nature of Christians in America. We are so easily duped by any charlatan or demagogue who will stand up and proclaim that he's a believer and proclaim that he's on their side, when in fact all he's doing is a clandestine, secretive maneuver to stab them in the back, to harm them even more, while they expect that they're doing well. It's really a very sad event. And Chuck Baldwin, I think, is keen on pointing out exactly what Christians need to be thinking about in their own Christian worldview when we think of inauguration of presidents like George W. Bush, with his track record in the Middle East, the Patriot Act, abortion, and so forth. Well, here's what Chuck Baldwin has to say. Yesterday, President G.W. Bush took the oath of office and delivered his second inaugural address. As political speeches go, this one was rather brief, only consuming 4 typewritten pages. Following are excerpts along with my abbreviated comments. Quote, "I am determined to fulfill the oath that I have sworn to, and you have witnessed," unquote. President Bush, January 20th, inaugural address. Unfortunately, President Bush either has no intention of fulfilling his oath to preserve, protect, and to defend the Constitution of the United States, or he has no inclination as to what the Constitution says, because virtually everything he has done since being elected in 2000 has been egregiously unconstitutional. From expanding unconstitutional federal funding and oversight for public education, to intensifying unconstitutional federal police encroachments upon our freedoms and liberties via the Department of Homeland Security and Patriot Acts, to unilaterally and unconstitutionally ordering the invasion and occupation of Iraq, President Bush has demonstrated a callous disregard for the Constitution. To now proclaim that he is determined to fulfill the oath that I have sworn is meaningless rhetoric. Quote, "The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world," unquote. This statement formed a redundant theme throughout the president's speech. For example, Bush also said, "The ultimate goal of ending tyranny around the world, and one day this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of the world." Still, other similar statements include the global appeal to liberty and a world moving toward liberty, etc. The tenor and tone of the president's speech are very clear. G.W. Bush intends to use America's armed forces for imperialistic and expansionist purposes. Therefore, I believe it is all but certain that Bush will order our troops to invade and occupy Iran and Syria, and perhaps even plans an attack against North Korea. It is yet to be seen how long Bush's military aggression will be tolerated by the American people. After all, the costs in terms of American lives and tax dollars are so far incalculable. One thing is certain, we have not yet begun to see the tip of the proverbial iceberg. The United States, the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors, unquote. Of course, the United States has ignored oppression, says Chuck Baldwin, for decades. The two most egregious examples of this are China and the Sudan. Of course, this has been pointed out a number of times here on the Tyranny Response Network by the Tyranny Response Unit as well. Chuck Baldwin is right. The communist Chinese government is one of the most prolific murder machines in world history. The toll of oppression and death inflicted upon the Chinese people by this killing machine is impossible to calculate. Yet the United States has invested billions of trade dollars into this monster with absolute disregard to the suffering souls of China. President Bush has continued the one China policy of his predecessors and has freely imported China's slave labor products to the point that America's manufacturing base has all but disappeared and our trade deficits continue to break all-time records. Likewise, President Bush has turned a blind eye to the suffering people of the Sudan. The Chinese-sponsored Khartoum government has murdered more than 2 million people during the past 2 decades with utter impunity. The oppression and brutality inflicted upon the Sudanese people staggers the imagination. Men are crucified, women are raped into submission, children are tortured and sold into slavery. Yet the White House seems totally oblivious to their plight. I'm going to continue with this letter when we return from a quick break. This is Dr. John Coben with Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network.
Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of their finances? We know that God works miracles in people's lives, but He has not chosen to provide manna from above to help us meet our needs as He did with the ancient Israelites. As Christians, we should be leading the way as good stewards. Since we do not spend money on vices like non-Christians do, we should be able to save more. We want to work hard and save our money so that we can have something to give to missions and to the needy. In addition, we want to regularly set aside a portion for retirement. Christians should not have to rely on taxpayer-funded government programs for retirement. No Christian wants to become a burden to their family or church during the ever-lengthening period of old age. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. We are an independent financial planning firm. We specialize in finding creative custom solutions to meet your savings needs. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
You're listening to the Tyranny Response Network. Go ahead. Make your day.
Indeed, that's what we're trying to do, is make your day today. This is Dr. John Coben. Welcome back to the show. You can reach us if you have a comment about what I'm talking about this morning, the inauguration of Bush from a Christian worldview perspective, as well as a comment on Chuck Baldwin's letter, which his fine letter, which we've been reading in its entirety. You can reach us at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or feel free to send your questions and comments to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Be happy to read those on the air and discuss them. Continuing with Chuck Baldwin's remarks, he quotes again the president from his January 20th inaugural address, "The unwanted have worth," quote unquote. "I would like to believe that President Bush," says Baldwin, "would include unborn babies in this statement, but his actions on this subject prove otherwise. More than 4 million unborn babies have been mercilessly slaughtered in the wombs of their mothers since George W. Bush first took office in 2001. Abortion on demand is still practiced undaunted in these United States, rhetoric to the contrary notwithstanding. Regarding abortion, President Bush and his fellow Republicans in Congress have proven to be paper tigers. They talk pro-life during an election campaign season, but they have no intention of actually saving the lives of the unborn." So true, Chuck. Go for it, buddy. Even the partial birth abortion ban, Chuck continued, bill, which Congress passed and President Bush signed, is nothing but an elaborate ruse. That's a trick. That's what a ruse means, folks. To make Christians and pro-lifers feel good about voting Republican. There was nothing of substance to it. If anything, the partial birth abortion bill serves to cement abortion on demand into the legal fabric of America by singling out only one abortion procedure, the least one used, no less. It accounts for less than 1% of all abortions. All remaining abortion procedures are thereby certified to be tolerable and legal. Beyond that, President Bush has increased federal funding for both domestic and overseas abortion providers to record numbers. He has consistently refused to make the life issue pertinent to his selection of federal judges. In fact, reports I have read indicate that no less than 2/3 of his judicial appointments to date are either neutral or lean pro-abortion. That is hardly the track record of a true pro-life leader. Add to that fact that both Congress and the President have the authority to end abortion on demand any time they would choose to do it, and one easily sees through Bush's pro-life facade. Congress could end the federal government's endorsement of abortion on demand by exercising their constitutional authority granted under Article 3, Section 2, to regulate and accept appellate jurisdiction of the federal judiciary, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Such action would clear the way for state legislatures to outlaw abortion on demand in their respective states. However, President Bush has shown no propensity to encourage Congress to fulfill this constitutional obligation. He has not even taken a position on Judge Roy Moore's Constitutional Restoration Act, which was introduced in both chambers of Congress. In addition, the President has the power to end abortion on demand by refusing to execute what he considers unlawful and unconstitutional traditional Supreme Court decisions. After all, the Supreme Court is not a power unto itself. It is one of the three co-equal branches of the federal government. As designed by the founders, each branch holds a check and balance on the other. This means the judicial branch has no power to execute any decision or opinion. That authority belongs exclusively to the president. For example, President Thomas Jefferson refused to honor the Alien and Sedition Act. After being told the Supreme Court upheld the law, Jefferson equipped, paraphrase, "Fine, now let's see if they can enforce it." Obviously, the court has no authority to enforce its opinion, so without Jefferson's assistance, the bill became moot, and note that Jefferson was not removed from office by Congress. The point is that if President Bush truly wanted to end the slaughter of the unborn innocents, he could do it. By declaring unborn babies persons under the Fifth Amendment, he could issue an executive order to his Justice Department that the federal government would not interfere with those states that would choose to enact laws against abortion. Again, this would allow state legislatures and state governors to implement abortion laws as they deemed necessary. Yet neither the Republican-controlled Congress nor President George W. Bush has done anything consequential to end abortion on demand. So much for George Bush's statement, "The unwanted have worth." I really wish I could be optimistic about President Bush's second term. I cannot. I'm afraid that unborn babies will yet be undefended. Furthermore, I fear this president is leading America into a federal police state at home and into an era of military expansionism overseas. I pray I'm wrong. And so do I, Mr. Baldwin. Thank you for that very insightful note. Folks, we need to get a grip on the fact that George W. Bush is not the Christian president. He is not the one out there to help bring in the kingdom of God, support godly principles, or even support constitutional and liberty principles. As a pro-life libertarian, I can't agree more with what Chuck Baldwin has had to say. Abortion on demand, or any kind of abortion as it's practiced today, whether it be the partial birth variety or just the so-called birth control variety, as Consumer Reports came out with in its February issue, that we can economically find the easiest and cheapest and safest way to remove the uterine contents, as it puts it. Yesterday, on yesterday's show, we discussed that. This sort of diabolical activity is certainly antithetical to all libertarian principles, not just for constitutionalists, and therefore, but also for all true libertarians. We have to oppose abortion. It is the most repugnant, fundamental evil that we can imagine. That those who are human beings are and who are innocent, that is in the sense that they're not convicted of any crime or wrongdoing, are simply slaughtered, burned to death by saline, chopped up into pieces by a razor-sharp edge on a suction tube, or punctured in the back of their skulls as they're being born and having to have their brains evacuated from the skull so that they die. This is the brutal, wicked, evil behavior that occurs on a daily basis, and on a yearly basis, we have a death toll of well in excess of 1 million, probably closer to about 1.5 million murdered innocent children or babies or fetuses or uterine contents or whatever euphemism you want to use every single year in this country. That atrocity could be stopped by the president, the Christian president, the ostensibly Christian president, the supposedly Christian president, the dubiously Christian president of the United States, George W. Bush. Folks, it's time to wake up, time to not be gullible. He is not the Christian president. He simply uses the right words and phrases to make you think he's on your team, and then he laughs all the way to the bank and all the way to his glory hole where he enjoys his power and prestige. This man is not doing what Christ would have him to do as a Christian. Now, having said all that, I would also be quick to add that I do not expect states to ever behave in a Christian manner. Some people do. I think Chuck Baldwin might be one of those who does. I do not believe that the state in the United States or any other part of the world will ever be aligned with God or promote the kingdom of God. And George Bush is indicative of this. The reason that people like Michael Badnarik or Michael Perutka are not elected president is simply because it is off limits in general for Christians to be involved in this type of government power, with this level of government power. Christians and those who are the leaders of God's kingdom and His church rarely, if ever, see political power. And if they ever do come to political power, or if there are ever short-lived periods in which you might find a few Christians scattered here and anon, you'll find that their power does not last. That although they put a check against Satan and his work and his kingdom through states for a temporary period of time, it is so short-lived and so mixed with other vileness that it can hardly be called Christian in and of itself. Even the founding of our great nation was tainted, folks. There's no one in the founding fathers that has more respect for me in my mind than Thomas Jefferson, as far as a political philosopher and someone who stands up for what's right. And I also like Patrick Henry and Thomas Paine and George Mason. These were great men. And certainly later on we had Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, just tremendous Americans. But folks, even during the first 80 years of this country, we had many vile institutions that continued to exist. We had questionable activities even in the creating of the Constitution. Remember, slavery was still around from 1776 and even before, of course, all the way through until 1865. Everywhere it was available. And in addition to that, well, in certain northern states, of course, it was, I backtrack there, in certain northern states, over time, it was outlawed or extremely regulated until 1865 when it was completely abolished. We also had little ploys going on when the Constitution was started up. We have, for instance, people who could not get their continental scrip paid off under the Articles of Confederation. It was completely worthless. Also, in addition to that, you had people who had made loans to the Continental Congress or the new government of the United States that weren't getting paid back. Well, the Constitution was a means for them to receive their cash back. So there was a big economic interest in going with the Constitution as it stands. It's a flawed document. It's not perfect. It may be the greatest political document ever created, but it's certainly flawed here and there, and that's one example. Well, we're going to continue this discussion in a minute, but right now we need to take a quick break. This is Dr. John Coben with Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network.
You're listening to TRN. Disinfecting the Modern Mainstream Media. Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.
This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Welcome back to the show. We want to remind folks that this is Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. I am the Tyranny Response Unit here to defend liberty, to promote the cause of truth and justice in this land, and to bring hopefully American and especially Christian Americans back to a better understanding of the liberties, truths, and rights that they have in this great land. We'd appreciate your phone calls to 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. If you're listening to the show live this morning, if you're not listening between 7:30 and 9 o'clock in the morning, you're listening to recorded broadcast, and we're thankful that you're doing so. We've already heard comments from people in Oklahoma and California and other parts of the country are listening to the show by the recording, even though it's in its infancy, only a couple weeks old now. And we appreciate that, and we hope you continue to spread the word. The webpage, policyofliberty.net, is updated every day with a new show, and the previous day's show is moved to a link that says yesterday's show. If you look down, scroll down the page at policyofliberty.net, you'll find where you can click and get the current shows, the current recorded broadcast for the show, and we appreciate you listening to that broadcast. But if you are listening live in Greenville, you can reach us at 864-201-6955. You can also send your questions and comments by email to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Please do encourage the show in that way by writing an email or by giving a phone call to the show this morning. Well, we were talking about abortion a minute ago, and this raises some very interesting questions for the Christian worldview, we have to admit. let's suppose you're in an abortion clinic situation, just for a moment. Let's say you were a fly on the wall. Now, say you were better than a fly on the wall. You had secretly come inside the abortion clinic, even by trespassing, and you were sitting under the table, and somehow you go unnoticed that none of the staff or the abortionist can see you there. And let's suppose there is a woman laid onto the table, and in the midst of the operation, so-called operation, the murder procedure. Let's say the woman might be 7 months pregnant, and you see a number of people in the room there. There may be one or two assistants, like an anesthesiologist, a nurse, another medical assistant besides the so-called physician that is in there. In addition, you might have a person there with some dry ice and a Federal Express packaging. He's somebody who markets the body parts that would come out and sells them. Did you know that even on the internet you can find a price list? There's an economic market right now for chopped up pieces of body that from aborted fetuses, you know, two legs or two kidneys or a heart or an infant brain. All of these have a market value, and people sell them, trade them regularly, not only for stem cell research, but for other sorts of medical research. And as long as they're fresh, harvested fresh, as they say, disgusting as it may be, there can be a very strong market for those things to be sold. So at any rate, you're in this room, and you see all these people around doing their various craft, and the murder procedure begins. Would it be wrong for you, at the moment the womb is open and the threat is there, whether it be by saline injection or by the vacuum tube or anything else that they might use at that point, probably it wouldn't be a vacuum tube. Let's say it's by saline injection. They start inserting the saline, and you see them starting to kill the unborn child. You step up out from underneath the table. You begin to brandish your .357 Smith & Wesson revolver that you have, and you realize you have 6 shots. And you tell the man immediately to stop. Or even if you don't, you just levy the barrel at his head and you pull the trigger. You kill the abortionist, the murderer. Is that wrong? Is it wrong for you to defend the unborn with force? This is a huge question in the Christian worldview. Do we have a right of self-defense? That's a big topic, and we've discussed that topic on shows recently. But what about defending somebody else? Is it right for Christians to use force to defend somebody else? Well, this is the abortion issue is a huge issue, obviously, and a huge case in modern thinking, and Christians have been put down, and other people because they have abortion doctor shootings and so forth. But what makes it what's different about the guy that sits up with his rifle on a building, and when the doctor comes out of his house and gets into his car and starts driving away, he shoots him, or he just it blows up the building when some people are inside there? What's different about that than the example I gave where the guy's under the table watching the murder go on? Well, folks, think about it. It shouldn't take you too far or too long to figure out that there is a huge difference between the two things. In the former case that I gave you, the abortion or the person under the table is an eyewitness to a crime. And any time a Christian or anyone else is an eyewitness to a crime, he does not have the obligation to defend the person being harmed, but he does have the right to do so. He can do so and be free of any criminal behavior by killing the person, by killing the aggressor in the situation. The problem with the drive-by shooter or the abortion bomber is they are not eyewitnesses to the crime. They're making judgments based on hearsay, which is a chaotic, unlawful thing to do. They simply hear that the guy has committed abortion, or maybe he's even made statements that he's committed abortion or committed murder. But until we actually see it happening, there's no way for us to make a judgment that it's actually the case and go ahead and take the person's life. But if you are right there in the clinic, and if you are seeing, even if you see it, you know, a leg come out and be cut off, then you do have the right to defend. And that may sound radical to you, and perhaps it is to the modern, certainly if you've been listening to the modern mainstream media, it would be radical. But think about it in these terms. What if it were not abortion that was being considered, but instead you were walking down an alleyway or a street, and maybe they're in an alleyway, you saw a man there beating on a woman and raping her. You know, let's say he's just a thug, just taking advantage of this woman. Now, this man may be bigger than you. Would you have the right to pull out your same Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum revolver, level the barrel at him, and shoot? And you might say, well, I'd shoot him in the leg. Okay. You might also shoot the abortion doctor in the leg. But if you didn't shoot him in the leg, let's say you aim for the leg and you're really a bad shot and you hit him in the head and you killed him. Either way, the guy's dead. Did you do something wrong? Did you do something wrong by shooting the rapist? You defended the woman, the innocent person being violated and attacked by an aggressor, a predator. Was it wrong for you to do that? Most Americans, as far as I know, would say, no, it's not wrong to defend someone against an aggressor. Well, what is the difference, folks, between the woman being raped and the person inside the womb that's being cut apart? Can't hear the voice? Can't hear the screams? Well, I bet you're right. The unborn can't talk. It's still in the amniotic sac, perhaps. Can't speak. Isn't having enough air in his lungs yet. He's at such a state of less development than the woman. So there's some outward differences. But if both are human beings, we're not talking about defending a cow or a monkey or a fish here, folks. We're talking about defending a human being. There is no difference. If you are an eyewitness to a crime, you do not have the obligation to defend, but you do have the right to do so in law. You could defend either one and be just and before God and even before the law. Now, in the United States, that's not the case because we allow, or when I say we, the government allows murder to occur without any reprisal and without any option for people to defend, and that happens in the abortionist chambers. If you have a comment about that, if you disagree or if you agree, please give us a call at 864-201-6955, or that's 864-201-6955, or send your question and comment and or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. This is Dr. John Coben with Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network. We'll be back after this quick break.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of their finances? We know that God works miracles in people's lives, but He has not chosen to provide manna from above to help us meet our needs as He did with the ancient Israelites. As Christians, we should be leading the way as good stewards. Since we do not spend money on vices like non-Christians do, we should be able to save more. We want to work hard and save our money so that we can have something to give to missions and to the needy. In addition, we want to regularly set aside a portion for retirement. Christians should not have to rely on taxpayer-funded government programs for retirement. No Christian wants to become a burden to their family or church during the ever-lengthening period of old age. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. We are an independent financial planning firm. We specialize in finding creative custom solutions to meet your savings needs. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschool children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
Well, welcome back into the show. And at the moment, we are defending, or discussing, I should say, the whole issue of abortion and defending the right of an eyewitness to an abortion or any other murder to defend. Not the obligation that he might have to defend, but the right he would have in law. And joining us during the break on the phone was Chuck, who's calling from Greenville. And we'd like to welcome you to the show, Chuck.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you still have Daniel helping you with producing today?
There is. We have a special producer that comes into the show regularly now, and he is a homeschooled student who takes a break from his homeschool morning to learn how to do radio show production and then continues with his study right here in the studio. Daniel is doing an exceptional job for us.
I think so, too. I commend him. This is right.
Yes. He's a 13-year-old student. He'll be 14 soon. But as you know, homeschooling has just taken off in the last decade, and homeschoolers are truly a great great bullet in the cause for liberty, because homeschoolers are not going to be infected by either the mainstream media or anything, even mainstream television to a large extent, because of their specialized training. And I think our future leaders are going to be, in many cases, homeschoolers. So anyway, welcome to the show, Chuck. Were you listening to the conversation about abortion?
Yes, I was. Got a little problem here. I really don't know how this kind of real-world experience and running a radio show can compete with taking roll and watching people throw spitballs at school. I mean, you just got to get your mind right, John.
Yeah, and Daniel doesn't really know what he's missing. He could be out there making the spitballs up or doing worse things. You know, when I was in public school, we always did far worse things than that. But he's missed all that. He's actually learning how to do something productive and interesting, and he actually enjoys it. Isn't that right, Daniel? You actually look forward to coming down here in the morning, don't you? Getting up at 5:30 in the morning to come down and study and get. I come down and read the news early in the morning, folks. But Daniel's in here setting up all the equipment and the recording and making sure the host has a glass of water and his email's working, all those kinds of things. He does a tremendous job of doing that. He's excited to do it. It's just a fun event, and we're very glad for him to do it. And it's a productive piece of thing that he's doing. Anyway, go ahead, Chuck. What was your question or comment?
Okay, so on the issue of defending somebody else, I don't think that's the same as self-defense, because we weren't delegated the authority to use deadly force. I don't see that delegation anywhere. That it seems to me the state has delegated the right to use deadly force, but the individual is not. So I think you would have a perfect right to help defend a second person. For example, you gave I think the one in the alleyway works better. You see a mugger, you got a weapon with you, maybe you threaten him with the weapon, but there's no need to shoot him and kill him. If at that point he threatens you, then it becomes self-defense. But if he goes away peacefully, then I think you've taken it as far as you need to.
Well, this is an excellent point. So what you're saying, in actuality, if a Christian were in that situation, the first thing he would do is, I said, even in the abortion situation, you would brandish the weapon and tell him to stop. And then if he goes away, then you've won. You've done your duty. You haven't killed anybody, but you've also stopped the aggression against the fetus, and or as you put it again, in the alleyway, against the woman being aggressed. But beyond that, wouldn't you say, and in law this is certainly the truth in the case of rape, that if you just decide to shoot without asking him to go away, there is no penalty.
I couldn't tell you what the law is. It seems to me that you've gone too far. Okay, I would not do that personally. Let's take the example a little further. Let's say that you run up on a murder. You see the murder being committed. You're a first-hand witness. It just happened right in front of you. They didn't know you were there. Maybe you came up behind them. I still don't think you've got the right to use deadly force. You have a right to detain the person, be a witness against them, and see them lawfully prosecuted.
Right.
I would not feel justified in taking on myself that role of executor to punish the person myself.
Yes, you bring an excellent point up. I don't think that you would want to do that in any circumstance. However, if the guy has the gun, let's say he's aggressing the woman by gunpoint in the alley, you would be able to use your gun, tell him to drop the weapon and stop. In fact, you wouldn't want him just to walk away with his weapon in his hand and the hand and his finger on the trigger, because at any moment he would be a threat by turning around and firing upon the woman or upon you. So you would want him to make sure he's want to make sure he's disarmed and walking away. If he would turn around, however, and begin to aggress you by even lifting his weapon towards you, at that point, then you would say it's self-defense entirely, and you would have hardly any other choice but to shoot. But then would you shoot, Chuck, at the heart, the head, or a leg? What would you do then?
No better shot than I am. I'd probably shoot for the heart.
Yeah. Okay, so as soon as he becomes an aggressor to you, then the circumstance changes. So, well, you bring up a great point. I mean, as Christians, we're not out just as vigilantes trying to be the executioners, and that was not my point. It's simply that it would be justified. Your actions would be justified. No one would question you if you killed the rapist, even if you didn't ask, you know, him to stop first. There's just not going to be anybody who's gonna in law say, okay, you're a murderer because you stopped this act from occurring. Although in the course of wisdom and in terms of the Christian worldview, we would not want to pursue that course. The first thing we would want to do is try to get the guy to stop and walk away. And if he wouldn't, we might even think about shooting him in the leg or something. And then if he absolutely turned around and started aggressing us with the gun where we thought our lives were in jeopardy, then we'd aim for the heart. I think I'm in total agreement with that. Now, what do we think about the abortion issue, though? Why is it different, do you suppose, Chuck, in American law, that the abortionist can just do what he wants, and if I were to go in with a gun, and even being the eyewitness and telling him to stop and assuming he wouldn't, and he turns around with a knife in his hand or something else, which I normally could shoot if it was a rapist, why can't I do that? I mean, what do you think about that?
I think there's a very simple reason for it, is that we have not afforded the fetus the status of person in the United States.
Right.
That's the key difference. Once we get past that, and I think science is on our side there, the person, we now know a lot more than when these laws first developed, that the person, for example, has a full set of DNA. We have better pictures of the person in the uterus, so we know they have a beating heart, they're moving, that they feel pain, all these things that we didn't know when all this started. So today, I think our understanding would lead us, if we'll listen to our understanding, apply it, to say that is a person and afford them the protection of the law.
Yes, that's actually an excellent point. However, if we take the whole personhood argument, which is the key argument, and Chuck's absolutely right, by the way, the reason there's a difference is because the law does not recognize the fetus as a person. Although in places they will prosecute, what was that fellow, Peterson, for a double homicide, claiming that the fetus was a person in certain circumstances. So in some places in law, they do recognize it as a person, but as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, if you want to voluntarily kill this fetus, these uterine contents, you can do so with impunity. But the whole idea of personhood is problematic for us, especially for those who would take a libertarian position, even a constitutionalist position, because what it says is that government or some other social apparatus, whether it be philosophers at the 10 leading colleges or 1,000 leading colleges or other group, decides when a human being becomes a person. It's rather artificial. The common person or any person does not naturally think of a human being as necessarily a person. And this sort of legal fiction rose up really in the last 400 years, starting with slavery. If we think about it seriously, though, we have some real trouble. Why would we presume that a human being is not a person? And, well, they had to create the legal fiction, if you let me indulge myself for just a moment. Slaves were always considered to be human beings. Black people were never thought of as being fish or monkeys or cows. They were human beings. And as human beings, they would normally have rights as being persons. Not only political rights, like to sit on a jury or to vote, but also rights to life, liberty, and property. And yet these were denied because government institutions were permitted to decide who has rights and when. And this is a very key thing. When we say society hasn't recognized the fetus's personhood, don't you think that's dangerous, Chuck? Don't you see that there's a problem when you let government decide who has rights and when?
Somebody has to decide, and so I think government, in a way, is how we arbitrate our highest disputes. So that's sort of a natural thing. But I think what it does illustrate is our great capacity to rationalize. mm-hmm. something is in our benefit, we can sometimes grasp onto arguments that are pretty far-fetched and say, yep, you know, as long as we can connect those dots, we'll go with it, even if there are obviously better ways to connect them.
Okay, I want to make some comments about that. We've got to run to our quick break here. I really appreciate the call, Chuck, and I hope you do call again, and I hope others call in about this important issue on Christian Worldview. This is Dr. John Coben with Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to TRN. Warning, Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. Is it okay for a Christian to become wealthy? Did you know that 8 out of 10 Americans will face retirement with little or no savings, even Americans who had good incomes? At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. Integrity Group is an independent financial planning firm that offers a wide range of services. We specialize in finding creative, custom solutions to meet the needs of each individual. Do you have concerns about providing for your retirement? Do you want to ensure that catastrophes like disability or long-term care will not wipe out your savings? Do you need to have your assets protected from creditors? Do you want tax-advantaged growth of your savings? At Integrity Group, we recognize that time passes all too quickly. Sound financial planning is not something to be delayed. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
You're listening to the Tyranny Response Network. Go ahead. Make your day.
Welcome back to the show. This is Dr. John Coben on Christian Worldview, the Tyranny Response Network. You can reach us at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. And you can also send questions and comments by email to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Right before the break, we had a very interesting phone call from Chuck, who brought up some important points about this whole abortion scenario and the right to defend. And he made a very good point about there being a difference between being the right to self-defense and the right to defend someone else, and when we might actually apply lethal force. And our first rule, especially as Christians, even though it would be legal to use lethal force immediately, we would want to try to deter a criminal or would-be assailant or aggressor from doing his craft and going away, whether it be shooting him in the leg or just brandishing the weapon and causing him to be fearful for his life and running away. And then if he continues to aggress, then we might kill him. Those are excellent points. We appreciated that very much from Chuck's call. But Chuck raises a philosophical question that I wanted to comment on that I think is even more crucial. He said someone has got to decide when rights are. In our society, we've decided that basically the government is allowed to do that. Folks, this is I'm going to have to tell you, this is a very dangerous position to step into. And although Chuck is correct in that people have decided that government can decide when we have rights, this is not the vision the founding fathers had. And if it becomes the vision that's widespread, it will mean the great vast debilitation and derogation of our rights and really destruction of liberties that we have in the United States. And I'll tell you why. If our rights come from government, our rights can also be taken away by government. If government decides and determines that it can grant rights to when somebody is allowed to be alive or when they can be killed, then it can also change that on its own whim. It will be subject to the special interests, to the power struggles, to the corruption, or anything else of the state. And once the state has and wields the power of deciding when and where rights can be doled out, the end is near, my friends. Remember, Adolf Hitler decided that although Jews were human beings, they do not have any rights to life. Why? Because he was following his own particular philosophy that suggested that Jewish people caused a great deal of grief in society, that whatever as other reasons might be. Hitler decided he could exterminate them, that government could take away their rights to life. Well, this is a real problem. When slaves are certain races of people like blacks were said to be human beings yet not persons by the state. The state took away their right to life. The state became lords over those slaves and those black folks. This is very problematic, folks. The founders of this country believed, as Jefferson so eloquently described in the Declaration of Independence, that our rights are inalienable. That is, we believe and hold that our rights come from God directly to life, liberty, and property, or the pursuit of happiness, and that those things cannot be altered or changed by government. Now, someone would say, and perhaps Chuck would say, well, look, that's just some people who came up and decided that philosophy. Well, that's correct. Some people did come up and determined that that philosophy was correct. But that philosophy is correct, and if it's not, then we lead ourselves into the Star Trek kind of world, or the Adolf Hitler kind of world, the totalitarian world of not only the unbelieving and unregenerate, but of all of those who would like to usurp power against other people without any reprisals. We end up with tyranny, we end up with chaos, no order, and no substance to life as soon as government is the one who purveys, gives us our rights, and can take them away. So we need to be very careful on this point. This philosophical issue is what we live or die by. If government gives us our rights, it can take them away. And if they can take them away, we have no hope. But if government is it comes after our rights, our rights come antecedent to the state, whether they come from God or otherwise. If you're an atheist, you can still believe that rights are antecedent or inherent or natural in human beings. Then we have a chance to have liberty and to use government as a means to simply protect those liberties. And that has to be our ultimate goal. Well, again, I welcome any other phone calls if you want to discuss this very important issue. But I'm telling you, folks, this is it. This is the one we make that makes or breaks us. If we don't have rights antecedent to the state, then all hope is lost. We might as well just go into totalitarianism now. I mean, it's going to happen at some point unless we can uphold that particular position. We're going to take just another quick break. We got a little bit behind on our break schedule today. We're going to take a quick break and be back in just a minute. This is Dr. John Coben, your Tyranny Response Unit on Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network.
You're listening to TRN. Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
Disinfecting the modern mainstream media, Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.
And welcome back to the program this morning. By the way, the Tyranny Response Unit, if you care to meet for lunch and meet me for just a moment, will be at California Dreaming today at about 12 o'clock, from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock. If you've listened to the show and you just want to be an encouragement to me and meet some of the other listeners perhaps, please come by and feel free to stop in for just 5 minutes at California Dreaming, or if you want, pull up a separate table and join in with the conversation. California Dreaming at 12 o'clock in Greenville, by Pelham and 85. We have a couple of interesting news items or emails today. I'm going to go ahead and go off the abortion topic for the moment. If you're interested in talking about that more, by all means, send an email or give us a call. Emailed questions and comments can come to questions at policyofliberty.net, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can also phone us or call us at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Well, I have an email here from Oscar just reminding us about something that was somewhat interesting that I didn't know that may relate to the Christian worldview to some extent. It's the history of the Washington Monument and the Latin phrase that is inscribed on the top that says Laus Deo. I didn't know that was there, by the way, and I would appreciate Oscar bringing this to our attention. And he says the following. I guess he's actually quoting a story. He says, I thought that you and the others may like to see this. One detail that is not mentioned in D.C., there can never be a building of greater height than the Washington Monument. With all the uproar about removing the Ten Commandments, etc., this one is worth a moment or two of your time. I was not aware of this historical information. On the aluminum cap atop the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., are displayed two words, Laus Deo. No one can see these words. In fact, most visitors to the monument are totally unaware that they are even there, and for that matter, probably couldn't care less. Once you know Laus Deo's history, you will want to share it with everyone you know, but these words have been there for many years. They are 550 feet five and a quarter or an eighth inches high, perched atop the monument, facing skyward to the father of our nation, overlooking the 69 square miles which comprise the District of Columbia, capital of the United States of America. Laus Deo, two seemingly insignificant unnoticed words, out of sight and one might think out of mind, but very meaningful, placed at the highest point of what was the most powerful city and most successful nation in the world. So what do these two words in Latin, composed of just four syllables and only seven letters, possibly mean? They very simply, they mean, praise be to God. Though the construction of this giant obelisk began in 1848 when James Polk was president of the United States, it was not until 1888 that the monument was inaugurated and opened to the public. And he goes on, I won't read the rest of the article, but it is somewhat of interest that there was a religious element at the founding of our nation, as early or as late as 1888 or 1848, there was still a considerable amount of religious sentiment among people who were even in the political process. Now, that does not mean that the state was good in general, that it was enacting great things, although the American state has been far more benign than other states in the history of the world. In fact, it's one of the greatest achievements of human history that our state has been so relatively tolerant and benign towards its citizens. The vast majority of people, the vast, vast masses of people have suffered under oppression and tyranny by states. And our founding fathers saw a way that we could get limited government and indeed avoid so many of the pitfalls that other people had been exposed to. Unfortunately, those things are eroding now, especially because we don't believe anymore that our rights come from God alone, but that they come through the state or can be changed by the state. But nevertheless, that was part of the founding. Well, I thought that was interesting reading, and you may have a comment about what we should think about there being praise be to God in Latin written at the top of the George Washington Monument in Washington, and maybe the principle behind that of the architect who created it. I'm not sure that the government actually voted to put it there. I think it was all more of the design. But you may be interested in making a comment about that, and you're welcome to do so at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. We also have on Yahoo News, a listener alerted me to this, that the Associated Press has shown that one-room schoolhouse faces $10,000 IRS fine. In Bayard, Nebraska, a tax error totaling less than $40 has resulted in a $10,000 fine for the Hill Public School, a one-room schoolhouse. The IRS informed the school district of the discrepancy on June 1st, 2003, and wants the fine to be paid, Rhonda Maxey, school board secretary, said Monday. Maxey says the accountant is to blame for the error, which he repeated a dozen times on the school quarterly tax return from 2000 to 2002. We weren't notified by the IRS as to why they let it go so long. At any rate, they want to pay, and now the public is being asked to contribute to the fine. They're looking to sell some things to raise some money. Well, the IRS, I don't know what to think about that. The IRS attacking the public school, I guess that's a good thing. Anything that attacks the public school is a good thing in my mind. However, having to go out now and extort money and more money from people in the community through higher property taxes or otherwise is appalling, of course. But this is the sort of activity we get from the extortive, confiscatory nature of this very fraudulent institution in the United States government. Did you know there are over 50 taxes paid by Americans? We're coming up on a break real quick. I just wanted to read. Somebody had emailed these to me. Some people say, well, those who don't pay income tax, for instance, aren't really paying taxes to support the government. Well, guess what? You know any other taxes there are out there, folks, that people pay that maybe you aren't even aware of? Let me read you just a few of these. Building permit taxes, capital gains tax, cigarette taxes, corporate income taxes, court fines, which are indirect taxes, dog license tax, unemployment tax, fishing license taxes, food license taxes, fuel permit taxes, a gas tax, which is 42 cents per gallon in most places, plus any estate additional taxes, hunting license taxes, telephone federal universal flat fee tax, telephone federal excise tax, school tax, toll booth taxes, recreational vehicle taxes, sales taxes, road uses taxes, usage taxes for truckers, service charges taxes, septic permit taxes, real estate, of course, and property taxes, Medicare tax, marriage license taxes, luxury taxes, local income taxes, well, liquor taxes for those who might drink liquor. Well, someone's paying those. Telephone federal, state, and local surcharge taxes. Telephone minimum usage surcharge taxes. Telephone recurring and non-recurring charge tax. Telephone state and local tax. Telephone usage charge tax. Toll bridge tax. Toll tunnel tax. Traffic fines, which are also indirect taxation, trailer registration tax, utility tax, vehicle license registration tax, vehicle sales tax, water registration tax, well permit tax, workers' compensation tax. I think I'm being taxed to death, and I am. In the great United States of America, we live in an extortive society, folks. You work for the government at least half of the year. Did you know it? All that money goes to taxes one way or another. This is Dr. John Coben with Christian Worldview. We've come up on our half-hour break. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of their finances? We know that God works miracles in people's lives, but He has not chosen to provide manna from above to help us meet our needs as He did with the ancient Israelites. As Christians, we should be leading the way as good stewards. Since we do not spend money on vices like non-Christians do, we should be able to save more. We want to work hard and save our money so that we can have something to give to missions and to the needy. In addition, we want to regularly set aside a portion for retirement. Christians should not have to rely on taxpayer-funded government programs for retirement. No Christian wants to become a burden to their family or church during the ever-lengthening period of old age. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. We are an independent financial planning firm. We specialize in finding creative custom solutions to meet your savings needs. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
This is Dr. John Coben. Welcome back in for the last half hour of Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network. I have a couple of other interesting articles and stories today which I think are important to bring up for the Christian Worldview. In fact, I've got so many things I'm sure we're not going to get to today as we had planned. I'd hope to continue reading a little bit of John Robbins' article on Christ and Civilization. We might get a chance to do a little bit more of that today at the end of the show, as well as raise maybe even the second question on the list of 17 questions that are available for your viewing at towards the bottom of policyofliberty.net, the homepage. Those questions can be responded to by email 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We'd encourage you to read those questions and think. That's what they're there for, to help you think about issues. And we might deal with the second one, or at least mention it today, and then carry on in tomorrow, or Monday's broadcast and in the following week. Well, there's a couple of things I wanted to get to, though, before that. One is I received an email from Eric. All Eric was doing was emailing me an article in The Scotsman, from Wednesday, January 19th, 2005, it's entitled Tsunami Hit Ties Told, Buy Six Planes or Face European Union Tariffs. Fraser Nelson is the political editor of The Scotsman, and he's writing the following. Tsunami struck Thailand has been told by the European Commission that it must buy six A380 Airbus aircraft if it wants to escape the tariffs against its fishing industry. While millions of Europeans are sending aid to Thailand to help its recovery, trade authorities in Brussels are demanding that Thai Airlines, its national carrier, pay £1.3 billion to buy its double-decker aircraft. The demand will come as a deep embarrassment to Peter Mandelson, the trade commissioner, whose officials started the negotiation before the disaster struck Thailand, killing tens of thousands of people and damaging its economy. While aid workers from across Europe are helping to rebuild Thai livelihoods, trade officials in Brussels are concluding a jets for prawns deal, which they had hoped to announce next month. As the world's largest producer of prawns, Thailand has become so efficient that its wares are half the price of those caught by Norway, the main producer of prawns for the European Union. To ensure that the Thais cannot compete, European Union officials 5 years ago removed its shrimp industry from the European Union's generalized system of preferential tariffs designed to share Western wealth with developing countries by trade. The European Union has instead slapped a tariff of 12% on its fish, three times that imposed on prawns from Malaysia, its neighbor. This is still less than the U.S. tariff on Thai prawns, 97%. Oh, I mean, we're more socialistic than the Europeans on that tariff. Not hard to believe if you're the tyranny response unit. It may be hard to believe for other listeners, but yes, we are there, folks. Any rate, I won't read the rest of the story. The point is this. Isn't it odd that our government acts like it's so interested in providing aid, or any government, and then they just go ahead and do these kind of tariff attacks against people who really desperately need jobs right now? This is not part of the Christian worldview, folks. Not only is extortion not part of the Christian worldview, but any kind of assault on people, especially oppressed people or hurting people, people who have been harmed by a natural disaster like this, should not be just victims of government force or any other force that can be used through the regulatory socialistic state. So I appreciate you sending the article in, Eric. That's a very enlightening story for us to know about. I also have a couple of other things of great interest here. One is an email I received from Greg, and Greg is talking about Robert E. Lee's, Greg is forwarding to me from Ken Bushin, the author of a book, and has a number of quotes from Robert E. Lee, talking about not only Lee's Christianity and his commitment to Christ, but also his willingness and reasons for going to war, and it has to do again with our idea of self-defense and the reason we might have states at all. And here's a quote from Robert E. Lee. He says, "I have fought against the." And by the way, this is Robert E. Lee's birthday was on Wednesday, and so rather than honor the plagiarist, womanizing communist like Martin Luther King Jr., we've chosen to honor on this network Robert E. Lee this week, who was a great patriot, a Christian. A person who loved liberty and was willing to defend that liberty with his life. He says, "I have fought against the people of the North because I believed they were seeking to wrest from the South the dearest rights, but I have never cherished towards them bitter or vindictive feelings, and I have never seen the day when I did not pray for them." In another letter from Robert E. Lee on January 5th of 1866, he says, "All the South has ever desired was that the Union, as established by our forefathers, should be preserved, and that the government, as originally organized, should be administered in purity and truth." And then in another letter to Captain James May on Rock Island on January 9, 1866, he says, "My conduct during the last 5 eventful years has been governed by my sense of duty. I had no other guide, nor had I any object other than the defense of those principles of American liberty upon which the constitutions of the several states were originally founded, and unless they are strictly observed, I fear that there will be an end to Republican government in this office." Well, you see, maybe I should be a charismatic because he had the gift of prophecy, obviously. I'm not a charismatic, by the way, but certainly Robert E. Lee's statement has become very true. We have lost, we are losing at least, our Republican form of government in this country. Well, isn't it interesting that Robert E. Lee, as a Christian, was willing to fight the North in order to defend the principles set forth in the Constitution, the ideals of liberty of our forefathers? Was he right or was he wrong for doing so? Why didn't he just submit to whatever tyrant that would come in, including Abraham Lincoln, and try to force him to accept a lesser form of government? Are Christians wrong when they stand up and fight for liberty? Is liberty important enough to fight for? Or is it just a waste of time? After all, we're just here and waiting for the rapture anyway, right? Well, not me. I don't believe in the premillennial perspective. But some people do, and I appreciate the fact that we can have differences on our eschatology and eschatological positions. But is that really a valid excuse or argument that I'm not going to fight for liberty. I'm not going to worry about what state we have in here or what government does to me. All that I'm going to be concerned about is preaching the gospel. That's the most holy thing. I'm going to preach the gospel, and whatever the government does, it does, and I don't really care. Is that what God calls us to do? Or contrary-wise, does God call us to have an active role in politics and in every area of life so that we might transform society, so that we might make an impact in other areas besides just gospel preaching? Or does gospel preaching entail more than simply the preaching of the word, strictly from the Bible? Is it an application to our current social structure, for instance, social events and so forth? I think it's the latter, folks. I really do. And if you have a comment or question about that, we'd be happy to hear from you. You can call us at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. You can also send your emails to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. We're up to a short break here, folks. This is Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on the Tyranny Response Network.
You're listening to TRN.
Tired of superficial and dull talk radio? Try some ear candy for thinking people. Listen to Liberty Minute with Dr. John Coben.
This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
You're listening to the Tyranny Response Network. Go ahead. Make your day.
Well, we hope we've helped to make your day today, this Friday, January the 21st, 2005, on the Tyranny Response Network. There are a number of deep questions that I've recorded in a PDF file. That's one of those files that can be read by the free Adobe Acrobat Reader. If you go to policyofliberty.net, scroll towards the very bottom, you'll find two of these documents there that can be read. And the first one of these links is Deep Questions for Dr. Coben's radio show. We'd appreciate it if you go ahead and have a look at those questions, think about them, and pick one of them that really interests you, and go ahead and write an email to the show commenting about it. It doesn't have to be a long email. It could just be something like, well, I agree, or I wonder about this, or make it just a paragraph or two that can be read on the air. We'd appreciate your interaction and knowing that you're thinking about these very important issues. Well, the second question in that list is the following. May a government legalize crime or actions that God says are wicked? Abortion would be a good example. They've legalized crime or abortion. So may a government legalize crime or actions that God says are wicked? What does the Bible mean when it says that states are ordained by God? That's Romans 13, 1, also 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 and following, talks about states being ordained by God. If a government does wrong, when and to what extent, passively or actively, may Christians oppose it? Were Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt criminals? Who or what defines what is a criminal? These are very good questions, I think, for those of us who are interested in a Christian worldview, and I hope that that those challenge you to think a little bit. Well, the answer to the first question is, I think, pretty clear. Government can legalize crimes, but it may not do so. It has no right before God or otherwise to legalize a crime like abortion. It may not legalize sodomy. It may not legalize extortive procedures like taxation as it currently stands in the United States. You cannot have those. You can do those things, but you may not, under God's economy, do so. So in terms of having the permission of God or the permission of what might be moral and right, no, they may not do it. But can they? Yes, obviously they have done so, and they continue to do so. The second part of this question is, what does the Bible mean when it says that states are ordained by God? This is a very crucial question. I was listening to John Weaver the Pastor John Weaver preaching on the Tyranny Response Network, his recorded show a little bit later in the day on 97.7, and found there that indeed Pastor Weaver believes that being ordained by God implies that the ordination is to a godly service, that the institution of the state becomes a godly aspect, or should be a godly aspect of God's economy in the world. That's only one way to look at it. To be ordained by God might not be so specific. For instance, if God ordains all things, as the Westminster Confession says in chapter 3, Article 3, verse 1, or paragraph 1, if God ordains all things, he also ordains Satan. He ordains everything that is evil that comes to pass, as a matter of fact. And therefore, the fact that it's ordained, something is ordained by God, does not mean things which are evil. So what does the Bible mean when it says states are ordained by God? I simply think it means that he controls it. He's the one who caused it to come into existence and is sovereignly using it for his purposes. Other people would disagree, as I think Pastor Weaver would, that ordained by God means it is there in a special way for a special function in fulfilling its role in enhancing, establishing, or bringing about the kingdom of God in the world. And I think that's inappropriate and incorrect. But there is a lot of room for Christians and men of good character like Pastor Weaver and I to disagree. If you have a comment about that, we'd love to hear from you at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. The third part of this question is this. If a government does wrong, when and to what extent passively or actively may Christians oppose it? Well, this is a huge question, probably not something we can answer right now, but it's going to depend on who you ask. If you ask me, I say I leave it up to the liberty of the conscience, liberty of conscience of each individual to decide when and where and to what extent he should resist. For some people, they're going to say, I'm just not going to pay taxes. I'm not going to pay any known tax that's going to support abortion or any other evil thing in this country. And that's fine. I as long as you have a moral conviction, or if you say, I have a constitutional right that incomes are not constitutional, the income tax is it only refers to dividends and bond interest and profits that I get from privileged activities. I have none of those, and therefore I have a legal right to not pay the income tax. If you go down that route and show that you have and believe that you have a legal right and can demonstrate it in law, I don't have a problem with it. If you're just being rebellious and you have an attitude of rebellion, I do have a problem with that because the scripture does not allow for that. But if you can show either a religious conviction why you can't pay the income tax, for instance, or a legal belief and doctrine that's well supported by court cases and legal theory and so forth, I leave it up to your conscience of whether or not you should or shouldn't do what you're doing. And I realize that that's problematic for some people, but for me, it's not. Other people would say that they may only oppose very few things that the state does, such as the prohibition of gospel preaching, or perhaps violations of certain commandments of God, like murder or theft. If we were forced to, some of the early socialists wanted us to do, take our wives and daughters and donate them to the state so that men who weren't able to have the fulfillment of being married would be able to do so by renting our wives and daughters or, taking them for a weekend. I think they would probably rebel against that sort of thing. Or if they're living in China and were told to abort their children after the first one was born, I think they would probably rebel against that. But those are very extreme cases that aren't common. They might say everything else we have to obey, period. There's just no chance. And if you don't obey, you're in sin. That's one extreme. There are other positions in between which are laudable and interesting to talk about, and from a Christian point of view, and I think in other shows we'll do so. There's just no way, and the time remaining today, we're going to be able to do that justice. But if you have a comment about that, we hope that you'll think about it and send us an email and respond specifically to that question. If government does wrong, when and to what extent, passively or actively, may Christians oppose it? We know they can oppose it anytime they want, but when may they? When may they be right before God in opposing tyranny? Were Lincoln, the last part of this question, were Lincoln and FDR criminals? Who or what defines what is a criminal? Well, in my view, and I think I'm in line with people like Albert J. Knox thinking and so forth, these were both the two greatest criminals in United States history. It wasn't Al Capone or Charles Manson that I looked to as being the greatest criminals in history, but these two people actually destroyed liberty and destroyed more lives and property than all other presidents combined. Abraham Lincoln meant the end of the American civilization as envisioned by the fathers. He destroyed Southerners and Southern lifestyle and Southern property. He confiscated confiscated property. He denied the writ of habeas corpus, and he enslaved people and imprisoned people without being charged. Abraham Lincoln was one of the most diabolical, egregiously wicked leaders of the history in the history of the world, and I put him on the same level, although not to the same extent, as Stalin and Hitler and so forth. FDR did everything that Lincoln did in an economic sense to us in his 10 years' time, and maybe even had more long-lasting effects than Lincoln. He destroyed sound money, confiscated gold, put us into a welfare state that we've never been able to get out of, and has considerably eliminated the rights and liberties of Americans on account of his policies. So yes, they're criminals. What defines what is a criminal? Well, the only way I can define what a criminal is, personally, is by God's word. As a Christian worldview, I think this is the only thing we can use to decide what a criminal is. However, criminal in the more modern sense, or the way of the public policy sense, would be defined by whatever the state declares to be a criminal. So if Stalin is not a criminal in Stalin's regime, but those who preach the gospel are, then that's what a criminal is. And so the state actually defines what a criminal is. Well, I don't agree with that, but that is indeed what happens today, and it's a shame. Just like the loss of rights, when government gets to decide who has rights and when, we have the same problem when we have the state being able to define who and what a criminal and what a criminal is. This is Dr. John Coben on the Tyranny Response Network. You're listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We'll be back after a short break.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Let's consider Christian stewardship in terms of financial planning. Saving, eliminating debt, lessening the burdens that can accompany a serious illness or accident. One of the most important reasons that we acquire life, disability, and long-term care insurance is because we want to love our neighbors as ourselves. After all, what kind of testimony do we give if we actually plan to rely on the charity of others? If we love others, especially our church and family members, we should do careful financial planning. Some Christians have 401k plans and need to be rolled over into a better investment alternative. Still others need to protect their wives and children by purchasing some inexpensive life or health insurance. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service. As an independent financial planning firm with a wide range of products, we're here to help you become a better financial steward. Find out about our many services at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
And that should have been evident today by today's show for sure. If any of you have not been thinking deeply, then you've just simply not been listening. We've been tackling or attempting to tackle today some of the most important philosophical, some of the most important policy issues of the day that make or break liberty and freedom and rights in the United States of America. Well, in the last segment of the show here, I'd like to quickly go back to this Trinity Review article called Christ and Civilization by Dr. John W. Robbins. You can get a copy of this online if you simply go to www.trinityfoundation.org. That's trinityfoundation.org. And scroll down the archives until you find the Christ and Civilization article from December 2002 through March 2003. We've been talking about this article because if we're going to understand the biblical admonitions towards submission to the state and other things that are recorded in Romans chapter 13, Titus 3, as well as 1 Peter chapter 2 and elsewhere, we need to understand something about the culture. in which the apostles were living in, and something about the government that existed at that day. It was Nero, the Caesar Nero, who was reigning at that time, the crazed lunatic who burned two-thirds of Rome, who murdered his own mother, and who violated every one of God's commandments in numerous ways, who was actually leading the country. It was a wicked ruler that Christians were told to submit to. And what we need to understand further was what Roman civilization was like. And we've already established and looking at John Robbins' article, that indeed the Roman civilization was hardly a peaceful civilization. It was not a tolerant civilization. They loved the state-ordained gods, and if you had any other god, unless it was ordained by the state, you were put to death. It was a barbaric culture in which odious barbarity against slaves was committed. Many of the, not most, or, well, close to half of the Roman Empire's inhabitants were enslaved to somebody else. So it was a cruel society, one which there was no justice, and although there was a peaceful system given over because of the totalitarianism, much like the peace you would have had in the Soviet Union, and there was a road system that was built by the military that allowed gospel preaching to be furthered in a more efficient manner, still this was not a society to be lauded or anything we would even want to be living in under any circumstances. Given that choice, we're living in a country like America or Chile or maybe even places like New Zealand today. Well, John Robbins continues in this article to talk about in the ancient world, life and death. He says, in the ancient world, abortion, the exposure of infants, infanticide, and suicide were common and legal. And at the coming of Christ, the Roman governor in Judea, Herod the Great, in an attempt to murder Jesus, ordered that all the male infants in Bethlehem and the region surrounding it, from 2 years old and younger, be put to death. We have a phone call coming in, and we'd like to take that call. Welcome to the show. This is Dr. Coben.
Hello?
Hello, you're on Christian Worldview with Dr. Coben. May I help you?
Yes, I'm sorry. I think I had the wrong number.
Okay, thank you. Well, we have not facilitated yet our call screening capability, and apologize to the listening audience for wrong numbers coming through. We will advance our technology at some point. Any rate, continuing with John Robbins' article, he says, the head of the Roman family had the power of life and death, patria potestatis, over his children and slaves. At birth, the midwife would place the newborn on the ground, where he would remain unless the father took the child and raised him from the earth. If the father did not lift the child, he, or more likely she, was left to die in some public place. The pagans exposed their children for many reasons, poverty, ambition, or concern about their quality of life, so as not to see them corrupted by a mediocre education that would leave them unfit for rank and quality. To quote Plutarch, the early Christians rescued thousands of children discarded by the pagans. Pagans also rescued thousands, and they would rear them to be slaves and prostitutes. If the infants were born with defects, they were frequently killed rather than exposed. Infanticide was not merely the practice of the pagans, it was their doctrine as well. Plato and Aristotle endorsed infanticide, and Seneca wrote, what is good must be set apart from what is good for nothing. That was Rome's view of life and death. What a horror. Law and government, writes John Robbins. Rome is commonly supposed to have given us our system of justice, but the law of Rome at the time of Christ was quite unjust. In a society as unequal and inegalitarian as the Roman, it is obvious that formal rights, however clear, had no reality, and that a weak man had little to gain by going to court. He continues, the systematic injustice of the Roman legal system was compounded by its systematic corruption. A Roman noble, or even a mere notable, had more in common with a godfather than with a modern technocrat. Getting rich through the public service never stood in the way of taking public service for one's ideal. And in fact, one quotation he cites, every public function was a racket. Those in charge put the squeeze on their subordinates and altogether exploited the populace. Cicero wrote that the senatorial way to get rich was to plunder the provinces under one's jurisdiction. Cicero prided himself on his honesty. After governing a province for a year, he was making the equivalent of $1 million per year, a sum considered quite small by his peers. incredible as it may seem, folks, to many Christians, the Roman civilization was not a godly civilization. It was an evil civilization. It was an evil empire. And Christians were to obey, but the idea that so many who hold the divine right position have today among Christian evangelicals, that the Roman civilization was a pillar of justice and peace and prosperity, is simply false. Government created chaos. The state, the Roman state, created chaos, poverty, and misery to millions of people. It was not the friend of the church. It killed Christ and the apostles. It was not the friend to even those who were common citizens, unless you happened to be in the aristocratic class and could get rich from corruption or this business of shakedowns, as we've read about. It upheld abortion, infanticide, suicide, and paganism to the nth degree, and we need to understand this if we're going to interpret correctly Romans chapter 13, 1 Peter 2. Well, we come to the end of our show today. We're so glad you've been able to join us, and we hope you'll join us again Monday morning for the next edition of Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on the Tyranny Response Network. God bless you.
You've been listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on TRN. Join us again tomorrow morning right here at 97.7 FM on the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.